Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
It's going to be the greatest ever. I think it's going to be even greater than the New Deal, because as great as the New Deal was, there were some racist elements and some sexist elements in it because it was of its time. And furthermore, of course, FDR had to compromise with some even bigoted politicians to get the New Deal programs through Congress. We're not going to do that this time because we don't have to.
You may have heard that voice recently on Fox's Tucker Carlson show, trying to describe some of the key elements of the Green New Deal that is emerging from Washington, D.C. The voice belongs to Robert Hockett, a law professor from Cornell Law School, who has an impressive profile ranging from his expertise on the Federal Reserve to being a primary consultant for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other rising political stars, leading the initiative for a sweeping revision of our economic and environmental systems. So greetings once again. I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host, welcoming you back for a very special conversation on It's Our Money between two monetary mavens who are closely aligned and so deeply versed in their policy interests and views that I decided we should just let them talk it all the way out today. Bob Hockett's opening comment gives you a sense of the excitement building around a new vision for our economy from a consultant to some of the biggest names in today's progressive politics. Bob is a consummate expert on monetary policy and our monetary systems and a return guest to this program. As a consultant to Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, his views describe the sort of paradigm-shifting policy possibilities that are now being exposed to the light of day by the mainstream media, which is trying to figure out how all this Green New Deal stuff is going to work. As a sign of its integration into the national conversation, the idea is getting both panned and praised by the pundits, who inevitably return to the boogeyman question of how can we afford it? As Bob and Ellen discuss this exciting new frontier, you'll get insights into the systemic changes being pursued that reflect the struggle to generate new social and economic outcomes, rather than to perpetuate the same old debates over monetary policy in our national mindset. Today's special extended conversation with Bob Hockett and Ellen Brown will touch on fundamental views about the Fed, key banking and monetary concerns. It will discuss universal basic income and the systemic changes that might be made to affect more economic equality, ways that we can get past the debt paradigm which allows bankers to rule the world, and how our national economy could be so much more productive. Well, that's a lot. It's a fine conversation, and with that introduction, I'm going to hand it over to Ellen Brown and Bob Hockett.
It's my great pleasure to be speaking with Professor Bob Hockett, who teaches law at Cornell Law School, is a fellow of the Century Foundation, and regularly writes for the New America Foundation. He also regularly consults for the New York Federal Reserve Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. He recently helped Senator Elizabeth Warren write the Accountable Capitalism Act and has been advising Bernie Sanders and has been meeting with the economic advisors for freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So that's all very exciting. I'm really looking forward to this. So, Bob, it's great to be talking to you again.
Oh, thanks, Ellen. It's just a joy and an honor, as always, to be on with you again.
So, Alexandria, I just wrote my last two articles were about how she could fund her Green New Deal. So she's really taken the media by storm. I think they're afraid of her, but the more they criticize her, the more she manages to get things out there that nobody else has gotten out there before. I mean, so the Green New Deal was, they don't dare say, well, they don't believe in, you know, green's no big deal, or the climate crisis is no big deal. So they always attack her on how are you going to fund it. And then she comes right back with, well, the same way that you funded, or the same way we fund undeclared wars and tax cuts for the rich. You know, nobody asks unless it's about a social program or something. But and I've heard you point out that she then, I mean, she doesn't go into how we fund those things, but in fact, how we fund them is we just basically write the checks, right? So do you want to go into that?
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. Yeah. So she's quite, she seems quite savvy, actually, about how public finance works, and she understands that the way we, quote unquote, pay for things is we simply pay for them, right? So the Treasury Department, of course, cuts a check or instructs the Fed to credit the relevant accounts, and that's that, right? And then if somebody, you know, turns around and says, well, what if those checks bounce, right? Well, she knows the answer. It's that, well, how would that happen, given that we are the source of the funds that go into the accounts, right? And then she's pretty good, I think, at pivoting then quickly and saying, well, look, you know, the relevant question isn't, you know, how do we fund it or how do we pay for it? We already know how we do that. We pay for everything in the same way. So the real question is just, you know, well, what about inflation, right? Which, of course, some people then ask. And then she's, of course, quite good at turning around and saying, well, we'll cross that bridge if and when we come to it. And one thing I'm always going to fond of pointing out here is that, well, look, you know, $3 trillion on Bush wars, no rise in the consumer price index, $1.5 trillion tax giveaway by Mr. Trump and his Congress, no appreciable rise in the consumer price index, over $1 trillion in tax cuts by the Bush administration, no appreciable rise at all in the CPI. And furthermore, of course, as you know as well as anybody, the Fed has been trying steadily for over 10 years now to maintain a 2% inflation target, and they've very, very infrequently even reached that 2% target from below. So that sort of suggests, along with the fact that there's no spread between inflation index treasury bonds on the one hand and ordinary treasuries on the other, that, you know, there's no imminent threat of inflation. But if it were to emerge, we know how to deal with that too, as of course does AOC. So, you know, I think that some of the press and some of the more sort of reactionary economists who don't actually know how money works or how finance works, let alone how our system of public finance works, you know, they've bitten off more than they can chew in trying to take her on, because she's more than a match for any of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to me that, like you say, we, even when we try to generate inflation, we can't seem to do it, that we are nowhere near full capacity, even though theoretically we're at full employment. We're obviously not. I mean, everybody knows people who are unemployed who would like to have a job. I mean, there are all those sort of people that have just been abandoned, so they're not counted in that. In the statistics.
Right. So when theoretically we're there, but really we're not, that sort of suggests that the theory that somebody's using might not be the right theory, right?
Wrong, right. And also that we need more money out there. I mean, it's not even just a matter of we have to be careful not to put more money in, but the system needs money. I mean, this is the theory I've been writing about ever since I wrote Web of Debt, like I started writing it in 2002, and then I always got criticized on it, the whole debt virus theory. But it seems to me that if money is created by banks, and they always want more back than they put out there, and over 30 years, a long loan, they want twice as much back at least. So clearly, there's never going to be enough money to pay off all those debts. And that's not even counting all the people that get money that's created by banks and don't return it to the system, you know, savers and investors,
hoarders,
and offshore tax havens, all those places that money goes rather than being returned to the system. So it seems to me that you could put a lot more money into the system than we've got now, and you have to do that in order to get out of this debt trap that we're in. Not just people, but governments everywhere are hugely in debt. It seems to me they could just stick that debt off, well, it seems to me we could either write off our debt or give it to the Federal Reserve and let them just keep rolling it over, you know, 100-year bonds or something like that. And, of course, they return the interest to us. What do you think?
Right. No, it seems to me that you're quite right about that, and have been for coming up on 20 years. And I wish people had listened to you at the front end. But at the same time, I'm kind of happy that at least some more are now listening to you who didn't before. But, you know, another point I'm fond of making in this connection is that, you know, the debt scolds and the inflation hawks often seem to talk about inflation as if it were a kind of unipolar phenomenon, right? That it just sort of happens. It just is itself, and it is nothing else, and it just does what it does automatically. If you spend, right, you spend, and then there's automatic inflation. And what one often has to do is sort of remind these people that inflation is an inherently relational phenomenon, right? It's all about the relation between the money supply on the one hand and the goods and services supply on the other. And that means, in turn, that if the spending that you engage in, for example, in a Green New Deal set of projects, actually generates more goods and services, then it is effectively creating the very stuff that will absorb the extra money that is created. And that means that you can kind of go on creating, so to speak, for as long as you're adding productive capacity, even after you reach the real full employment point, which, as you point out, we're very far from anyway. So in that sense, we have sort of two grounds, I think, or sort of two temporal stages to which to direct the attentions of these debt scolds and inflation hawks who are insufficiently attentive to the way money and finance work. The first is to point out that we're operating at much less than full capacity now, which is evidenced by the fact that the Fed consistently misses its inflation target from the bottom. And then the second point is to say, even if and when we reach the point of actual full capacity utilization, we are going to be increasing capacity itself and increasing productive, increasing the goods and services quantum that productive capacity itself results in the production of, to absorb even more spending, right? So there, in that sense, there are sort of two artificial constraints that some of these scolds are putting on our sort of capacity to realize what we are actually able to realize. And that is a much more just, prosperous, and environmentally sustainable society.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, I mean, they're not stupid. they must know it does serve the banks to keep everybody in debt, because if you don't have the money, you've got to borrow the money. You've got to borrow the money to pay for food and rent and all that. Mm-hmm. Plus, if you have to borrow, you're not going to be spending on goods and services. So you've got to give the people some money one way or another. And one way is to create jobs, but another possibility is just a universal basic income, which a lot of people are talking about anyway, just to create demand. So, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, that's only one prospect. I usually, when people ask me about that one, I usually say that, look, there's a very big or very broad menu of ways to kind of help get more money into the hands of those below the top of the distribution than they currently have, and thereby address the inequality problem, which, as you know, of course, is worsening by the minute, even as we speak. UBI is certainly one possibility there, and if it were done right, and not just in the form that some of the Silicon Valley sort of table scrap throwers seem to have in mind, then that could be very salutary and very helpful. Another thing I think that would be very salutary and very helpful is some form of the job guarantee or the employer of last resort function, which is also, I think, an important way not only of raising real wages economy-wide, but by essentially establishing a benchmark standard across the economy, which we as the public would have the capacity then to raise steadily over time and thereby effectively force all private employers to meet. And then there are other things we can do, which are, you know, I've got a book coming out fairly soon on means of getting more capital, right, more ownership in productive assets into the hands of more people across the country. Because, as you know, the overwhelming majority of Americans are reliant on labor incomes or labor for their primary source of income. Indeed, most don't even have any other source at all, right? They don't have stock or other forms of capital. And as we know, you know, thanks to Piketty, but also thanks to others, the returns to capital are much higher, much greater than the returns to labor. So if we really want to achieve something more in the way of a truly egalitarian society, going forward, we probably either want to diminish the returns to capital, raise the returns to labor, or spread capital more widely, or any combination of those three things. And it seems to me we've got a very big menu of things that we can do that would enable us to accomplish all three of those things, right, to proceed along all three of those pathways in order to address the inequality problem and thereby, you know, boost the consumer spending power of the polity as a whole, or the public as a whole.
Mm-hmm. So how would you spread capital?
There are a number of ways to do this. One way to do it is to offer incentives to firms, actually. So as you know, firms get a great tax deduction when they finance their expansions with debt, right? So they basically get to write off that debt. And insofar as we let them do that through the tax code, we're basically giving them a kind of a gift. We're encouraging them, in other words, to borrow in order to expand. It seems to me that that gift itself to be rendered more contingent. We might say, for example, one condition of our giving you the tax write-off on that debt financing is that you actually have to issue additional shares of stock and then distribute them to begin with, maybe to your employees, but maybe also to other certain classes of people, like maybe loyal customers, right? People who are regular customers of firms, or maybe people who are sort of trapped into buying from the firms because the firms operate either in monopoly or oligopolistic industries. Another way to do this would be to establish what we might call universal capital accounts on behalf of all citizens, maybe at birth, whereby maybe the public provides sort of matching grants of citizen-chosen corporate-issued securities into those accounts anytime the citizens themselves add those things into their accounts, right? There's a great variety of ways to do this, and I try to kind of lay out a full menu of them in the book that'll be coming out later on this year. It's called A Republic of Owners, not to sort of shamelessly plug myself, but I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk more about that later.
Oh, that's the whole point. That's great. So, which makes me think of this question or issue that I saw raised recently, that the government could pay off, I mean, they wouldn't have to borrow, that of course they could just print the money or create the money on their books, whatever, but that if they didn't do that, that what would the pensioners do? And what about the savers that need a safe place to park their money? But it seems to me, why should you have a guaranteed place that's absolutely risk-free that you are guaranteed to get interest on your money? I mean, it seems to me our whole concept of that we're entitled for our money to grow if we have the money is wrong, because half the population doesn't have any savings. They're mm-hmm. living paycheck to paycheck, so they don't get the benefit of that. And who is paying that interest? That half of the population that doesn't have any savings. So mm-hmm. I don't know how we would change that mindset, though, but everybody thinks you're entitled to get 2% interest anyway on your very, very safe money that you park with the government.
I think, Ellen, I think there's a way to do this where you don't have to change the mindset. I think there's just a much more, a much less destructive, much better way to sort of satisfy the desire that mindset is a sort of emanation from or sort of expression of. And it's this. I sort of think of it this way. A treasury security guarantees a certain return to those who buy one or hold one. And in effect, that means the government is effectively saying, look, you holders are going to have a piece. In a sense, you get a dividend from the growth of the country's economy over time, right? You're in a very indirect way. You're kind of invested in our economy and its long-term growth. But the way we do it, we're essentially requiring a cross-subsidy, right, from those who don't actually own those things. Well, one way we could deal with this then is we could say, okay, everybody is entitled to a national dividend as the national economy grows, and you're not going to have to buy U.S. Treasury securities in order to get that dividend. Instead, this will be sort of automatically conferred upon all of the citizenry directly by the federal government as the economy grows from year to year. And one way to do that, I mean, there are various mechanisms through which you could do this. If people had bank accounts in various public banks or private banks, the federal government, of course, could sort of pass along that dividend. But another way to do it, of course, would be if the Fed itself offered citizen accounts, let's say, to every citizen. So every one of us had an account with the Fed in the way that only the banks are allowed to have now in the form of their reserve accounts. Then our citizen accounts could be automatically credited on an annual basis with what we might call the national dividend. And this would effectively give everybody what currently goes only to those who hold Treasury securities, and it would do it in a way that doesn't actually take from anybody else, because it's all gravy in effect, right? If the economy is actually growing year on year on year, then we can simply share that growth, right, that increment of growth on an annual basis with the entire population that ought to benefit by it. In terms of a national dividend instead of in terms of interest, then there's no reason to maintain the interest at all anymore, right? In other words, basically, the basic idea behind the interest is we're saying, okay, look, you're investing in America by buying these treasuries. You're entitled to some kind of return, especially if the country sort of fares well and prospers, which it does tend to do over the long run. So what we could do is we could convert that debt stake into an equity stake. That's what we would be doing if we thought in terms of a national dividend instead of in terms of, you know, interest earned on treasuries. I'm completely with you on that basically, you know, that keeps us in the so-called, you know, debt paradigm, as some people would call it. And I don't see any reason to, you know, sort of stay stuck in that particular way of thinking, right? And this gets to your entitlement question as well, right? So the theory on which the, you know, payment of interest is predicated is in fact a false theory, right? So the theory is that, okay, look, when the government issues these treasuries, it's borrowing from people, and people aren't willing to lend to the government unless there's some kind of a guarantee in the form of some kind of a guaranteed return. And of course, when the return is guaranteed like that, we call it a debt investment, and we call the return interest. But as soon as we recognize that actually the Fed is not borrowing from people by issuing securities, it's in fact issuing those securities to soak up excess money to sort of combat inflation, or it's doing it to provide people with a so-called safe asset that they can hold in their portfolios and not have to worry about, as soon as we recognize that that's the real function of Treasury securities, we have at that very moment effectively recognized that we don't actually have to use debt instruments at all to accomplish the ends that actually matter to us. Because think of what those ends are. The first end is, well, financing government operations. Well, we do that simply by spending. We don't have to sort of issue securities to do that. And then second, we want people to have some kind of a safe asset that they can rely on. That's what the national dividend would be. Basically, it would grow anytime the economy grew. And although we do, of course, have recessions sometimes or depressions where there's loss, in general, in the long run, as we all know, the economy grows. So in the long run, this would be a very safe asset, in effect, right? Your entitlement to a national dividend because, you know, essentially the U.S. economy pays a dividend in the long run, right? That is the return. And it doesn't come with any sort of debt or other sorts of strings of that kind attached. So it seems to me that that's really the right way to think and the right way to go where this sort of thing is concerned. So to sum up that, you know, sort of long-winded reply, the two functions that Treasury debt is said to perform, it does not actually perform, and indeed there is a better way to perform, and I think that's the national dividend route.
So you have written that banking should be a public utility because, mm-hmm. I mean, banks in general should be public utilities, just like water mm-hmm. and power and electricity and mm-hmm. We would argue the airwaves, stuff like that, mm-hmm. things that we share. Because they can't operate without the government. They're dependent on the government, so mm-hmm. they're getting the benefit of the government, so they should be under the authority of the government. So, but mm-hmm. I was just wondering, how would you set them up as public utilities? Like, what kind of laws would have to be changed, or how could mm-hmm. we get from here to there?
So I think there are a lot of ways we can do it, Ellen, and in that sense, this is one thing that makes me sort of feel even more, how should I put it, maybe zealous or, you know, proselytizing about it, because there's so many different ways you could do it. One way would be simply to establish a whole parallel system of public banks that are connected directly to the Fed as a kind of a public option that would be competing, as it were, with the private options and thereby sort of keeping them honest. Another way to do it would be simply to convert all of those that are private banking institutions into public institutions now. Another way to do it would be to go with the Fed account idea that I mentioned a moment ago, where everybody has, right, a citizen account with the Fed, and we might say that you can tap into your, or you access your account with the Fed in any number of ways, perhaps through your phone, perhaps through a network of ATM machines, perhaps through common carrier requirements, where we say all private bank ATMs have to offer access to themselves for purposes of citizen account transactions free of any assessment of fees as a condition attached to the privilege of having private ATMs. Another possibility that I imagine is if we went the citizen account route, this would presumably put a number of private banks out of business, or at least cause them to have to sort of diminish their sizes, so they might then in turn want to spin off a bunch of their branches, you know, their various branches and ATM machines, and those could simply themselves be taken over by the public, so that we would have public bank branches and public ATMs sort of operating in parallel with the remaining private bank branches and private bank ATMs. That's another possibility. Another possibility would be a little bit more locally focused in the way that some of your proposals work, so that you might have every state having a kind of a Bank of North Dakota equivalent, and then that Bank of North Dakota equivalent in every state would have its own branches throughout the state, and then those various state public banks would presumably link up either with the Fed or with some sort of similar institution, kind of as we did with the Federal Home Loan Bank system in the early 1930s, which you'll recall was a kind of a parallel system that we established specifically in order to handle mortgage finance and the like. And it had its own Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which was a kind of a counterpart to the Fed for the home loan banks. We could do something along those lines too, but instead of with federal home loan banks, these could be, again, public banks that are organized at the state level, but that perhaps if they have to meet certain conditions to then be part of a federal network that then gives them access to federal resources and federal accommodations of various kinds of the sort that the federal Home Loan Bank Board used to give, and then, of course, the Fed itself gives right now to all of the commercial banks out there.
That's interesting about the Federal Home Loan Banks. I'll have to look into that further. I did do some research on it. It's totally private. I know that when we met with DBO, the Department of Business Oversight, that would give a charter for a state-owned bank. We were trying to persuade her to, or there is a bill on, or an attempt to bring a bill here in California to carve out a special charter for publicly owned banks, because it doesn't seem like the requirements that we have for private banks would necessarily apply to them. And so we were saying for collateralization that you could get standby letter of credit from the Federal Home Loan Banks. And she said, well, she was a bit suspicious of them, that they were, you know, part of the shadow banking system. They weren't really public, and that even though they were quasi-public, that they could go down. I don't know. What's your thought on that? Do you think they're, like, totally secure? And
well, so I think she's right that, you know, they morphed into something else. And as you'll remember, our mutual friend Bill Black got into considerable trouble for a brief while when he was the chief enforcement officer for the FHLBB back in the 1980s, right? This was what the whole Keating 5 scandal was about. And, you know, that great hero, John McCain, who we all celebrated a couple of months ago, was, as we remember, part of the Keating 5, who basically tried to come down on Bill Black to get him to stop enforcing the law against a bunch of the Federal Home Loan Banks that were basically violating their mandates and violating the law more generally in various things that they were doing by the 1980s. This was all, I think, a product of the whole, you know, Reagan, the so-called Reagan Revolution, and the deregulatory moves that were made during the Reagan years. What they effectively did, and what they effectively did is what Republicans often seem to do, which is they come into office, they find a fantastic public utility system that has been established by some Democratic administration in the past, and they convert it to some sort of private use. They maintain just enough public support to render it a kind of a rent extraction opportunity for the private cronies who they want to benefit, but then they privatize those aspects of the operation that essentially allow then for those private cronies to profit by it. And I think this is a classic story basically of corruption, you know, typically overseen by Republican administrations. Not to sound too partisan here, but that just seems to be how it's worked historically. I would say that the Federal Home Loan Bank system, which was initially put into place by actually a Republican administration, the Hoover administration, and it was a very forward-looking and I think a very kind of progressive idea, which then characteristically the Roosevelt administration came into power and expanded and made even better, worked quite well for its first, you know, early decades, for its first, say, 50 years. And then it was screwed up by Republicans who got their, you know, their sort of paws on it and let their little private cronies and campaign financiers get their paws on it. And then they screwed it up and turned it into something much more like the way, like what your friend sort of characterizes it as being.
Wow. So like the attempt to privatize the post office, any good public utility. I mean, they don't allow the government to make money. It seems to me when they say that government can't run a business, it's because they don't allow us to, they don't allow the government to run any businesses. As soon as something mm-hmm. becomes profitable in any way, it gets mm-hmm. privatized.
We're listening to a conversation between Ellen Brown and Professor Bob Hockett. In this last section, they'll touch on privatization, reinstituting the power of public investment, housing, education, corporate enterprise, even the prospect of a 5% annual growth rate for the U.S. economy, as well as Bob's experience of the rising political star Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whom he has been consulting, along with the new generation of millennials who are accompanying her in Congress, and his enthusiasm for the promising days ahead.
You remember when Trump said, right when he was going to come into office and right before he came into office, he said he wants to impose an immediate ban on all Muslims coming into the country until we can figure out, quote unquote, what is going on. That was, of course, rubbish and nonsense and deeply offensive and unconstitutional. But I'd like to use that very phrase and say I would like to impose right now a ban on all further privatization of any kind until we can, quote unquote, find out what's going on. We know actually what's going on, so we'll find out pretty quickly. And then right. I think what we should do is go a step further, and we should re-socialize virtually everything that's been privatized in the last 50 or 60 years. So Fannie and Freddie, right? Fannie, as you'll recall, began as a public institution. It operated very well then. There was some nasty redlining and racism, but that was a bug, not a feature. That was simply a product of the fact that Fannie was a public institution at a time when the U.S. government itself was racist. We're no longer like that, I like to think. I think we should basically permanently re-socialize Fannie again, and we should permanently socialize our system of home mortgage finance as we had it from the 1930s up into the early 1990s again. And we should not privatize the post office. We should keep it public. And I think we should probably de-privatize large tracts of the banking sector, as you and I have been proposing for a long time. Recognize that these are public utilities, so let's run them as public utilities, i.e. not-for-profit, and in a manner that makes them accessible to all Americans, every single American.
Wow. Great plan. Could you talk a little bit more about your upcoming book?
Sure. So it should be out by late this coming summer or early autumn. It's called A Republic of Owners. And the basic idea is it kind of riffs on what I said earlier about it, which is that I basically take stock of a particular set of circumstances that we've been living with for quite some time now, really pretty much ever since the early part of the 20th century. So the idea here is that, you know, in our first 150 years or so as a nation, we had public policies that were pretty much devoted to ensuring a very widespread of the ownership of productive assets, right? So this is what the Homestead Acts were all about, and there was more than one Homestead Act. We had a sequence of Homestead Acts, and the last one actually was passed in the early 1950s. And what all of those Homestead Acts were about spreading a productive resource, in effect a kind of capital, as broadly as possible across the population. The land grant acts, which were complementary to the Homestead Acts, were about spreading higher education, free higher education, across the entire population so as to enable the population to make productive use of the productive assets that we shared or spread so broadly. And we did this kind of thing quite well up until the early 20th century, and that was essentially the source of the creation of the great American middle class. It's the reason that our economy grew so rapidly and why prosperity tended to be shared so broadly, at least over those who were not racially disadvantaged. And happily, you know, we've gotten, I think, I'd like to think that we've gotten partly past the racism that was sort of so deeply embedded in our culture back then, so that if we were to kind of continue along the route that we used to travel when it came to the spread of productive assets, that we would do it in a non-racist way now. And indeed, I'd like to think that we would actually give special advantages to those who were historically underprivileged or disadvantaged in the past now by basically putting a thumb on the scale in favor of even more productive asset spreading to those populations as a way of redressing the crimes that we committed or that our polity as a whole committed against them in the past this time around. But the basic idea is to, resurrect that old asset spreading form of public policy that was so emblematic of American public policy until the early 20th century. That requires us to do something more than spreading land now, of course, because we've now spread the land, right? Back in the 19th century, that option was always available because there was so much land. And of course, we continually committed genocide against the original inhabitants of the land in order to be able to spread that land. Going forward, there's not much more land. There's not land to spread in that way. Secondly, land is no longer the most important productive resource in the way it was when we were a primarily agrarian economy and society. And then, of course, thirdly, again, I would like to think that we're not going to commit genocide anymore in order to get hold of resources that we can spread widely. So the idea is basically to spread ownership in the currently dominant forms of productive capital, and that would be corporate capital, machine capital, business capital. And there are many, many ways to do that. One of the ways involves kind of replicating the sort of publicly financially engineered way in which we spread homeownership under the Hoover and Roosevelt era homeownership spreading programs, and also, of course, replicating what was essentially the same financially engineered means of spreading higher education in the way that we began doing in the 1950s and did all the way well into the 1980s until, the Reagan people began to privatize all of that stuff and turn it into a for-profit enterprise, which it had not been before the 1980s, and basically to replicate those means in the realm of machine capital, as we might call it, or corporate capital. So spread ownership shares very, very widely across the population. I think you and I have talked about this before. You actually mentioned yourself just a short while ago in this very conversation that, the overwhelming majority, basically half of the American population doesn't own financial assets of any kind. And then the remainder of those who do own some such assets own just paltry amounts of them. Something like 90% of all of the financial assets in the country are owned by not much more than 10% of the population, right? So firm ownership, business ownership, either indirect through, share owning or direct in the form of, say, sole proprietorships or partnerships, is overwhelmingly concentrated in a very few hands. So the idea of the book is to, basically spread much more widely that form of ownership. And if we do that, we get two really important benefits, I think. One is a much more just distribution of wealth and income, because, of course, the wealth in question generates income. And second is a much more stable economy in the long run. And here's what I mean by that. I call this will sound like a mouthful at first, and it'll sound kind of wonky, but when I maybe explain it, it won't sound quite so bad, I hope. I call this the income compositional symmetry principle. So here's the idea. If the national income is composed, let's say, of primarily capital and labor, and let's say 90% of the national income is generated by capital or attributable to capital, and 10% is attributable to labor, then ideally every citizen, every American, would derive 90% of his or her income from capital and 10% of his or her income from labor, right? So your income composition would be symmetrical, or would be essentially would replicate the national income composition. And the reason I think this is a good thing is, A, again, it seems more just in the sense that insofar as people's capital holdings now are not attributable to their virtue or their hard work, but is largely just a matter of inheritance or luck in the birth lottery, then you definitely get a much more just distribution of wealth, that is to say, of income-generating capital, if you approximate or move closer to conformity with the income compositional symmetry principle. And B, where stability is concerned, you eliminate in one fell swoop the principal source of stagnation and hyper growth in private debt. Because basically what happens is basically when the national income or when the national economy grows, it is automatically distributed in a manner that is symmetrical to its own generation. And another way of putting this then is to say that the nation, that the economy's absorptive capacity automatically keeps pace with its productive capacity, right? You don't have, it's basically a mismatch between productive capacity on the one hand and absorptive capacity on the other is simply not occasioned, right? It simply does not happen. So you don't have to worry about long-term loss of consumer purchasing power, which provides incentives then for public policymakers to rely ever more heavily on cheap debt for consumers, enabling them basically to kind of maintain the style of life, of living to which they become accustomed by other means when their incomes are diminishing, right? You have basically their incomes automatically keeping up with economic growth precisely because the sources, the composition of the sources of economic growth in the economy as a whole is replicated in the portfolios, so to speak, of all the individual citizens or all the individual participants in the economy as a whole. So you can think of it as a kind of an automatic Keynesianism, and that means it's sort of automatically self-stabilizing, and that itself is, I think, a tremendous virtue.
It sounds good, but I always sort of focus on setting up a parallel system because we can do that. But if mm-hmm. How do you get the assets away from the people that have it now? It seems to me that's where you're going to run up. What kind of laws would you have to change, and would they call that socialism or socialism?
No, I'm so glad you asked that. Yeah, so that's another big part of the book, Ellen, is it's designed, sort of a really important part of the book is, I sort of say right from the start, right, we seem to have a bias as a culture. We have sort of two biases that are in a certain tension with one another. On the one hand, we have a cultural bias in favor of ownership and even of an equitable spread of income-generating assets. On the other hand, we seem to have a kind of an allergy against confiscation and redistribution, right? Now, those two impulses are kind of at odds. So the question is then how to deal with that, which is, of course, what your question effectively just was. And so here's the trick, I think. What you do is instead of taking from those who currently have and giving then to those who currently don't have, you look at instead at new growth, new wealth generation, and you undertake to channel that new wealth generation disproportionately toward those who are currently underendowed. So in effect, what you're doing is you're leveling up rather than leveling down, right?
The new production by something that we, the people, collectively own, I guess. Is that correct?
Well, it doesn't have to be that. I mean, that would be one element, right? But another element would be to say, okay, you've got all these private firms out there. You've got a bunch of shareholders in them now, and you've got them, oftentimes expanding their operations by borrowing, and then they get a huge subsidy in the form of tax write-offs when they borrow in that way. What we say is, okay, henceforth, if you want to enjoy that tax write-off of that debt-financed expansion, you have to convey new shares to people who currently don't have shares. And so then what happens is when the firm expands, when the firm grows on the strength of that publicly subsidized debt that they grow on the basis of, now all sorts of people have a stake in that, right? All sorts of people who did not previously have ownership shares in those firms have ownership shares in those firms. And so now they're going to benefit directly by the growth of those firms in a way that they don't do now and that only the current shareholders do now.
Might there not be the problem, though, the idea of zero interest rate policy was supposed to be to get firms to invest in productivity, but instead mm-hmm. what they did was just buy back their own stock because they didn't have any consumers to sell that productivity to. I mean, mm-hmm. the market wasn't mm-hmm. there, so.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that's why, I mean, supply side strategies alone are just ridiculous, right? I mean, it's astonishing to me, and probably to you too, that anybody ever thought you could handle everything with supply side strategies alone. Indeed, in many cases, you don't even need the supply side strategies at all if you have the right demand side strategies. And that, in this case, of course, means boosting consumer purchasing power. And one way to do that, of course, is to get more income into more people's hands, right? I mean, people, again, you and I have been banging this drum for a long time, and so have some others. Some have joined us later in the game. Others were with us right from the start, and some others might have even been there before we were. I just don't remember or don't know. But basically, the drum to beat here is that, yeah, I mean, you have to focus on the dwindling of purchasing power below the top of the distribution. That means you have to recognize that the inequality problem is not just a problem of justice, it's a problem of efficiency as well. If you want an economy to grow, you've got to have purchasing power down below the top of the distribution. And that, and the ideal way to do this is to put in place mechanisms that automatically channel the benefits of growth to those below the top of the distribution, in addition to those at the top of the distribution, so that then basically growth is itself self-fueling, right? Because every time there's growth, then incomes below the top of the distribution grow, people demand more, and so then you get even more growth, right? That's how an economy grows. I don't see any reason why we couldn't actually anticipate a regular 5% or greater annual growth rate if we actually had the proceeds of growth automatically channeled to those below the top of the distribution. And that's one reason, I think, for this maintaining this kind of income compositional symmetry that I'm talking about. But it's also a reason for a host of other plans and ideas that you and I have been putting forth for a long time.
Wow, that's a lot. Okay, I'm looking forward to your book.
Oh, good.
Always good for me to sort of get, support on ideas that just seem logical to me, but to get somebody with your credentials to support that is great. So,
yeah, thanks so much again, Ellen.
I'm working with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. I mean, those are all our big hitters up there. So the whole Alexandria thing is so exciting that here's this young woman that dared to come in and challenge, and because she's got charisma, just like Trump did, and she's not reading off a prompter, she's just herself, she's very charming and very bright, obviously, and just
she's brilliant.
I think
she's a kind of genius in a way. I mean, she's just extremely brilliant when it comes to sort of the uptake on all matters economic. Of course, people have not adequately noticed, I don't think. The press doesn't seem to have paid adequate attention to the fact that she actually did her degree in economics, right? She's got lots of economic savvy, and she's talking to lots of really, really good people, lots of very sound economists, probably listening to some not-so-sound ones as well, just to make sure that she hears from everybody. So she's not, she's not one of these people who just, only asks, a few favorite people what they think. I mean, she's listening to lots of different people and then taking it all under advisement and then deciding for herself what makes sense. And then she's just brilliant at communicating everything and at dealing with all of these ridiculous attacks that are coming on the one hand from right-wing idiots and on the other hand from left-wing cowards, or I should say not left-wing, but, kind of pseudo-left-wing, but de facto centrist cowards. She's so good at dealing with all of these people. And I don't know how she does it, to tell you the truth. I mean, imagine that you're 29 years old, you've just become a kind of a national phenom. Only 1 year ago, you were tending bar and waitressing, and now, of course, you're the center of public attention, and you still handle it with just unbelievable grace and aplomb and wit, right? And even like a cheerful smile. I think, I might have collapsed under that kind of pressure, right? There's so much, and of course, so many people, as you know, have invested hope in her now. They're treating her like a kind of savior figure. I don't think that that's sort of inappropriate or inapt, but it is rather pressuring, you might say. It's an awful, very heavy weight to bear. And how she manages to carry it on those shoulders is anyone's guess. I mean, she must just have astonishing resiliency as a human soul, right? A very powerful, strong soul, in addition to a real brilliant person and a kind of a very loving and smiling sort of sensibility. She's really, I mean, she's the closest thing I think I've encountered, or that any of us in the country has encountered, to an FDR since FDR himself.
Yeah, and she's younger and healthier. She's got more energy.
That too, yeah. And knock on wood, and let's pray that she stays that way, and that the pressure doesn't build too much.
I was thinking about that I was like that when I was 11. Let's say I used to get up on stage and was absolutely unaware that a whole bunch of people were looking at me like I starred in a school play, and. It was just very comfortable, and I could just get up there. And then all of a sudden puberty hit or whatever it was, that suddenly this social awareness thing. And then you know, and you get all nervous. I mean, somehow she's still a child, it seems like, in that way.
She's,
you know, just the lack of fear of what other people think, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she's got the courage of her convictions, for one thing, and she's, I think she's just a very strong and forceful personality without being, you know, like predatory or aggressive in some kind of a nasty way, right? And that's another thing that FDR had, right? I mean, they often say that, you know, FDR just genuinely loved people, genuinely loved doing the right thing. And so he was always smiling. And, you know, I go back sometimes just when I need a little inspiration and watch, you know, an FDR speech, or I watch him kind of interacting with people. And one thing you always notice is he's always throwing his head back and laughing, you know, and he just seems to be genuinely delighted in people. And he even takes delight in battling with those who are attacking him in bad faith. He even seems to enjoy that. He's like the proverbial happy warrior. And AOC seems to have all of those attributes. And indeed, like you say, also to have maybe a stronger sort of physical core as well, partly because she's younger and partly because she hasn't been stricken with a terrible debilitating disease in the way that FDR was. So I find myself kind of pretty much every morning praying for her to stay healthy, stay strong, and for all of us to, you know, who are, including you, right? I mean, I don't mean any special closed circle. I don't have any privileged access of any sort, but just for all of us in the country who are fans of hers, I think we should all have her back, so to speak, because she really is fighting for all of us. She's one of us, you know?
Yeah, and this whole generation that's coming in, I mean, we saw that here in Los Angeles with the Public Bank LA groups, that they are so dynamic and young and sure. The leader, Trinity Tron, is like Alexandria. In fact, she spoke at one of Alexandria's presentations and introduced her to public banking. I think that may have been the first she heard of public banking. But that was my sense, too. It was like, thank God, the troops have arrived. Like, the young people are finally here to carry on.
Yeah.
A different breed there.
They say that this is the year that the millennials will become the largest generational cohort, right? So, in other words, just enough of the early, the sort of front end of the baby boomers will be sort of dying off as to render the baby boom generation now the second largest, with the millennials the largest. Now, to me, that means it's especially cool that Alexandria, who is herself one of those millennials, is coming into prominence. The baby boomers, I think, did a lot of wonderful things for this country. I'm from the next group after the baby boomers. I'm one of the Gen Xers. We were just a bunch of slackers. We really haven't done very much for anybody. But the baby boomers, I think we owe a huge debt of gratitude because they did a lot for the country in the 60s and maybe early 70s. And then I think that the next great group are the millennials. And she is, as you say, she's not the only one. She's the most prominent at the moment, but there are quite a few others coming along. And I'm, you know, if she herself is representative of the rest of that cohort, and if others like Charisse Davids and others who are coming out end up being representative of that cohort as well, then I think, you know, my slacker group of Gen Xers is very lucky because we didn't do anything to deserve this, but we're getting it anyway.
You just have to wait for the old ones to die off. You can't change their mindset. And the new ones come in,
the
and
Republican
they're just
ones.
So fresh. I mean, they can see it fresh. They don't have these old preconceptions.
They're not allergic to the public sector doing stuff, right?
And right. Socialism,
you know?
Isn't a bad word.
And I think a couple of early indicators of this were the way the Occupy movement exploded into something much larger than anybody thought it would in 2011, then the way the Piketty book became a big phenomenon in 2014, kind of a nerdy, wonky book about inequality, somehow becomes a national runaway bestseller in 2014. That was amazing. Then I think many people probably didn't think that Bernie's candidacy would be anything more than symbolic and a helpful way of getting some interesting ideas onto the agenda, but it turned into something quite viable that almost won. People, I don't think, saw that coming. That was another great early indicator. And now the huge victory in the House in early November, followed by, of course, the prominence that Alexandria has attained and that others have attained to. All of these, I think, every sign is just another reinforcement of the fact that we really are entering into a new time, a new era, which I think is going to be unbelievably great. It's going to be the greatest ever. I think it's going to be even greater than the New Deal because, as you and I know, as great as the New Deal was, there were some racist elements and some sexist elements in it because it was of its time. And furthermore, of course, FDR had to compromise with some conservative and even bigoted politicians to get the New Deal programs through Congress. We're not going to do that this time because we don't have to. We don't have to compromise with bigots anymore. Bigots are persona non grata. Bigots are to be ignored and marginalized. That's what they deserve. That's what justice requires and demands. We're not going to screw around anymore with that kind of crap. And so this time around, we're going to do the New Deal right. I think the Green New Deal is going to be everything that the New Deal was and more. And in that sense, it's going to be everything that the New Deal itself should have been.
Mm-hmm. I love the fact that they brought in social issues. It's not just about climate.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, they're only talking about studying the climate. In other words, they haven't absolutely decided what the cause is, because that is certainly controversial. But, I mean, everybody can see we've got a climate issue. But whether taxing carbon is going to do it, carbon emissions is another question, yeah.
Yeah, I think basically we have to proceed on multiple fronts. And you and the whole public will get a nice view of the full range of sort of spaces at which we're going to push forward on this. It's a very comprehensive vision. And again, in its full detail, it will be revealed very soon. So keep your eyes peeled, I would say, because this is going to be like the coolest thing that's happened again since the New Deal itself, and even better because it'll come without the racism and without the sexism.
Oh, that's great. All right. Very inspiring. I knew I was going to enjoy this interview.
I did too.
So it's been great talking to you. Do you want to tell people where to find, other than your book? Do you know when it might be coming out?
So it'll, again, probably at the very end of summer or early autumn. And if people want a preview, they're welcome to kind of reach out and, you know, contact me, and I'm happy to send a preview to anybody who wants to see it. So you could just send them to my law school website over at Cornell, or they could just email me. I'm very easily found by email, just robert.hockett@gmail.com, which is kind of amusing, isn't it? I mean, Hockett doesn't sound like a particularly exotic name, and yet I didn't have to add any numerals or other kind of bells or whistles to my Gmail address. It's just my name followed by gmail.com.
Okay, thanks very much, and thanks for all your input up there in high places. That's super.
You bet. Anytime, Ellen. Thank you so much, and we'll talk more, of course.
I've been speaking with Professor Bob Hockett, who is a law professor at Cornell Law School, among many other things, including advising currently Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.